Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 263 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. How you doing, guys? Thank you for tuning in. This week I'm joined by the amazing Zoe Ashton. You'll hear how long we've been trying to book this one. It surprised both of us, I think, because it didn't seem quite as long as it's been. But it's an amazing chat. Before I get into it, thank you for all the love for last week's episode with Ron Perlman. Yeah. That was a cracking chat. I really enjoyed it. I mean, this year in general, not that obviously we've been going for 5 years now, but a quick rundown if you're not up to date on this year. We've had Eddie Marson, Mark Miller, Adam McKay, Richard E. Grant, Joel Egerton, Mary J. Blige, Joe Cornish, Lolly Adefope, Stephen Merchant, Stephen Knight, PC Leon McLeod, one of the biggest episodes of the year. Johan, Harry, Winston Duke, Jade Adams, Jamie East and Ron Perlman. And there might have even been a secret episode in there somewhere. So, yeah, man, it's off to a hell of a start, right? Thank you all for tuning in. I'm going to give some plugs up front. First of all, I want to really plug Zoe's new book, Character Breakdown. I'm adoring it. We recorded this podcast on a Tuesday. I received the book Friday afternoon, and I was 2/3 of the way through by the time we met to record, and it's because I couldn't put it down. Obviously I like to read a whole book if someone's got a book out before a podcast, but because the book only came through last minute, I thought I'll read a chapter or two. And yeah, I think it's amazing the way she's structured it. It makes it so readable. There's some really important insights and tales and stories there. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. Zoe is also in Betrayal at the moment in London's West End. It's at the Harold Pinter Theatre. Velvet Buzzsaw is on Netflix. So go give that a look. We discuss all these things, but I thought I'll give you the plugs at the start, because I often have people tweet me saying, oh, what was that thing? And then, you know, they're all here at the start, and you can just come back and listen to this bit again. What else do I need to tell you? Obviously, you can join me over at patreon.com/scroobiouspip should you wish to. There's loads of good stuff over there. Poem of the Month, Distraction Pieces Rewind, loads of good stuff. The two books I mentioned, I was saying I'm going to put all the plugs in here so you can get back. I mentioned two books. There's a book by David Mamet. It's True and False, Heresy and Common Something of an Actor. It's True and False, basically. And I also mentioned the book of Disquiet by Fernando Pessoa. So if you want to go and explore either of them after our discussion, you're more than welcome. But there's loads of stuff. If you're getting any book after this podcast, it should be Character Breakdown, because it's fantastic. SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. Speaking of books, you can get both of my books at SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com, and loads of other stuff. I'm not going to plug too hard. I'm going to get into the podcast because it's a cracking one. I'll tell you now that at the end I'm going to tell you about who next week's guest is, and it's a really good one. I recorded it a month or two ago, and I've been excited to unleash it upon you all. I'll mention that at the end as well. Oh, I'm getting all ahead of myself. Anyway, this is episode 263 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the wonderful Zoe Ashton. I'm going to grill you until you give me all the truths.
Hard-hitting drama.
No, exactly. Well, I'm joined today by Zoe Ashton. How are you?
I'm great. It's so nice to see you.
I'm glad we're having this.
Me too.
I was looking in the prep for this. I was looking back, and we started trying to organise this in 2015. So you were one of the first people I hit up about
That's
having as a guest.
Insane.
I thought it'd been a couple of years, and I thought I'd have a quick scroll back, and yeah.
Can you believe
it? Years,
oh my God, it's finally happened.
I'm a big believer in timing, and it just feels at the moment you've got so many cool things going on.
Yeah.
And and things that you can talk about. Because the weird thing about the film or TV industry is half the projects you're working on you can't talk about yet and stuff like that. So it felt that this is the perfect time. So how's it all going?
It's going really, really well.
Yeah.
It's so nice to see a familiar face.
Great.
Do you know, the other thing is, I feel like I really wasn't that acquainted with podcasts
in
2015.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand what was going on.
No one did, man. It's
such
been crazy.
An analog
that,
girl.
Oh, it's crazy that it's kind of blown up now. And I was saying to a friend the other day, because I won't go into it, but I've been doing a podcast magazine as well, and I've been having all these meetings.
What's a podcast magazine, for God's sake?
It's just a magazine about... I'll give you one. I've got one on me. It's called Pod Bible. and I've been having all these meetings with, like, high-up people at Spotify and stuff like that, and all the time I'm like, just pretend I know what I'm doing. And a mate of mine kind of said, well, you know you do, because you were doing podcasts before anyone knew what it was. I was like, oh, yeah, I've just been kind of lying and blagging it, and it turns out it's actually...
Turns out it's actually a thing.
On. Yeah.
I've always been behind the times on everything, and it's actually like a badge of honour that I wear now, but I remember when I didn't know what blogs were.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what they were after they'd been out for a good...
Yeah.
4 or 5 years, and I just remember saying at a media-y type party to someone who was talking about their blog, I was like, can I just ask what is a blog?
Yeah.
And you've never known silence like it.
It's so key to have the braveness to ask those questions and not feel embarrassed. It feels like that's one of those situations where there's someone you see regularly, but they're only an acquaintance and you don't really remember their name.
Yeah.
But you see them too regularly. And blogs is the perfect example of that. You've probably nodded along about blogs numerous times.
Oh, yeah, many times.
At this point, I need to kind of ask someone what is... blog
this, but I am all up to speed now. I know what podcasts are.
Brilliant.
I've done some, and I feel I'm primed and ready for this awesome podcast. So thank you for having me.
It's all been prep. It's all been training to get you to this day. Now, there's tons of stuff I want to talk about. I want to talk, like, we're recording this in the Harold Pinter Theatre, where you're doing Betrayal at the moment, which I've seen. I loved. I want to talk about. I want to talk about your whole career in general, because as said, in 2015, you weren't in this play and also hadn't done your new book, which has blown me away. I've read 2/3 of it, I think, now.
Oh, thanks,
and I love it.
Groups.
I love the structure. I love the way you've approached it. It's
it's
great. But so we will go a bit all over the place. But I guess before we get to that, I figured... Or there's two things I noted before we get to that. The first is just a question of how often do you get emails or texts that have been... auto-corrected to Zane, because every time I've tried to type your name on Organiser, I think I have to be really careful to make sure, because it just always auto-corrects to Zane. So it's
that's so funny. I haven't
a confusing one for me.
I haven't had any texts or emails, but I get quite a bit of post.
Yeah,
with Zane.
Yeah, and it's weird because that's not a normal name anyway.
It's
auto-correcting to quite an obscure name as it is.
It's already obscure and it's gone even more obscure. I like the Zane over the Zor.
Yeah.
What's so interesting is I think if you have that thing on your phone that announces who's calling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On lots of my friends' phones, it says Zor.
Brilliant.
And lots of people call me Zor.
Right.
And I just. It's the O and R that I'm missing from the spelling
though,
of my name.
Yeah, it feels nicely futuristic. It feels like a character in something.
Yeah,
it's a good
true.
One to be announced.
Yes, yeah, so maybe that's what my Afro-futurist kind of personality is, my persona. No, Zane is a welcome autocorrect mistake as opposed to the Zora.
I love it. Well, that out of the way. The other thing I wanted to talk about was... We kind of came up on the spoken word scene and poetry scene at the same time.
We did.
And I wanted to kind of, because again, I figured you've probably talked about everything else career-wise a lot, but this is something that's kind of almost personal to us in a way,
totally.
Because it was that same kind of era. So what are your kind of memories of that? And is there anyone you remember specifically as a standout or anyone you enjoyed back then?
I remember you very much.
Excellent, that's lovely.
I remember Zena Edwards.
Yes.
Who's fantastic.
She had such a powerful presence on everything. Like, the first time I saw her, it felt like kind of similar to blogs. I had to pretend I already knew who she was. Because I was like, well, obviously everyone should know who Zena Edwards is. And it just felt like that. I felt ignorant for it being the first time I'd seen her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who was the... who is the amazing woman that used to, she wasn't a, well, she was a poet, but she used to sing with the guitar with Miles, her son.
Yes.
It was Miles and,
yeah, I can't remember. I know the exact
she's
woman
a
you
legend.
Mean.
Oh God. I can't believe that's escaped my tired brain. Anyway, it'll come back to me as we go. It, my memories of that time are so random. It's so interesting to see now what a scene the spoken word poetry scene is. It's an actual scene. Back then, I don't know how you feel. It wasn't really a scene.
No, you really had to dig.
There wasn't much public consciousness.
No. You had to really dig to find where the next event was and things like that. And yeah, you couldn't really find tons of it online. You had to go to one and there'd genuinely be someone flyering for another event.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go to that and try and become part of it all. But
I mean, it definitely wasn't being nominated for the Mercury Music Prize, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah.
Not in this country. And I'm going over to New York since being on the circuit in the scene and seeing what a huge world it is there, you know, and you can be a celebrity on that scene. You know, there's really well known people out there, and rightly so, because so many of them are incredible. But I just remember being 17 and a bit mad, and just a group of us got together at college and we just used to write poetry together.
Amazing.
Create art in bedrooms and hang out. I don't know who we thought we were. Do you know what I think? We thought we were these beat, this we're trying to recreate that Beat Generation sort of
completely.
Vibe, which obviously is just so beyond sweet and cute now that I look back. It's just so lovely. But we wrote stuff together as a little collective, and there was one day specifically where we ended up walking past the Vortex jazz bar, which used to be on Stoke Newington Church Street, where I'm from. Walked past it, it's now Nando's. It's just still so sad to me that happened. But it was this tiny, cool jazz bar, and we walked in and we went upstairs, and I think we were there literally just to try and grab a drink because it was the place that was still open.
Yeah.
And there was poetry happening
upstairs. Poe Jazzy. I used to run from there. The night it was Poe Jazzy. It was Joshua Edahen, Moose Rockwonga, and Inua Ellums were all
Inua. Yep, Inua is someone I still see, someone I remember from that time. Yeah. Niakwe Parks is someone else. And I thought, hold on a minute. We've got literally pockets full of poems here.
That's amazing that you were
And we blagged ourselves on the list to perform. Who did we think we were? It's brilliant. I'd never have the confidence to do that now.
I love that.
And we went up and we each performed a poem. And the guy who ran them, John Paul O'Neill, obviously we both know very well, is so committed to the poetry scene and to the spoken word. And he said, you guys should come back. You should start competing.
Yeah.
And that was it.
It's amazing.
We just, I think I, when I won the slam that I ended up winning, which made me at that time the youngest, I think, either UK or London slam champion.
Wow.
Which you then took, I think.
Maybe. I don't know. I did a few. It's such a mad scene, and it's a beautiful one because, again, you've summed it up perfectly there. I'll have people message me saying, like, how do I become part of a poetry scene, or how do I start? And at that point, no one was asking those questions.
No.
They were just doing it.
No.
And the poetry scene was five to ten people in a room above a pub or above a restaurant. It wasn't. It didn't have to be this big, I've planned it, I've got my experience. It was like, just get... And where I was out in Essex, there was a few nights I'd go to that literally, they've put some seats out in an empty room in a pub. And that was it. But
that was it.
You were seeing people like Kate Tempest and people like that, all just... And Holly McNish and all these were there and... Yeah, just having this impact.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I remember performing above a pub called Britain's Protection in Manchester, which is a really legendary pub in Manchester. But, it, you know, this tiny room upstairs, and it was, you know, pint, glass, put what you can in, and, you know, let's just all celebrate art in this very, very low-key way. But again, like you're saying, the talent that was on offer was just... It was mind-blowing.
And it's realising both sides of it as well, because you guys having the boldness to just approach and try and get on the list, you're going to think, oh, how can we be so bold? But equally, I know from the promoter side, they're scrabbling for people to get up and fill the slots and fill the time. So it benefits everyone. So it is that kind of, people might feel, oh, I could never do it. It's like, they probably have a gap for you to fill. So as long as you're up for getting that experience and throwing yourself out there.
It's a time that I remember so vividly, just for the sheer arrogance of youth.
Yeah, yeah.
I look back on that time and I think that was the incredible confidence / arrogance of youth. Completely. I would never deign to write a poem and say it in front of a crowd now. I think, yeah, I think the poem that I won, the slam that I won with, age 17, was written on the back of like a folder, like wow. from college.
Yeah, yeah.
It was written
yeah,
on the
yeah.
back of my college Brilliant. Folder.
Yeah.
Amazing. What an incredible way to express yourself at that time.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing of the youth side of it to not have those... I guess it's to not have the self-consciousness that would yeah. restrict you now. Because,
yeah.
again, I look at... I'm doing a thing on... where I'm going back through an old hard drive and reading some poems I've forgotten about Amazing. 10, 15 years old.
Amazing.
And this...
About the time we started yeah, trying to yeah, plan yeah, this podcast,
exactly.
then.
yeah, exactly that. They're so... cringy, embarrassing, but
yeah,
they needed to happen because it was that boldness to feel, again, to feel genuinely, I figured it out. I'm yeah. going to change it all with this poem. It's like,
100%.
You're a 17-year-old, you're an 18-year-old, oh, even amazing. Older. You're a kid and you think you're the one that, no one's realised this before, I'm going to say it. Oh,
it's so deeply felt. It's yeah. so deeply felt. And of course, you know, performance poetry, any kind of poetry, isn't just for young people to go up there and give it a go. It's for any age and, yeah. and any walk of life. But there definitely was something about being that young and saying, I've got something to say
yeah.
that
yeah.
I want everyone to hear.
Yeah,
and being encouraged for it. Not 100%. Being told to shut up.
Yeah.
And being at college at the same time and studying these texts. And, you know, I was doing English language and literature at the time and studying Shakespeare and studying Toni Morrison and going, these are all incredible texts and they're overwhelming and they're brilliant and I'm trying to connect to them and I'm, you know, also trying to find my place within this institution. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm having my own visceral response, but at the same time, I know I'm going to have to do an exam in however long yeah. And do a poetry. Literally, I'm going to have to do a poetry exam.
Yeah.
I was still studying That's for crazy. My poetry exams whilst performing poetry and trying to just fit into that institutionalized way of analyzing poetry, analyzing yeah. language. So it was such a brilliant counterbalance to all of that,
yeah,
you know, because
yeah,
I'm someone who's never really gotten on with institutions of any kind of nature. But because I had that world of my own,
yeah,
my little secret world, I yeah. felt like I could apply myself at college in a really different way and go, right, okay, I'll play the game.
Yeah.
Because actually I'm living the game in another, you know, different dimension.
Yeah. I love it. That's fascinating because it reflects your career or learning as an actor as well, I feel, because I'm reading the David Mamet's book and I find it's fascinating
really?
And he's very anti-establishment learning
yeah.
and acting schools and acting classes and pro learning on stage in
yeah.
front of the audience
yeah.
with the crowd
yeah
and you've kind of done both. I mean
yeah.
again it reflects in the poetry as well, the fact that you were studying poetry but then also out there doing it, so
converting
so
it
they
at
can
the same
say
time.
Oh, this isn't good, and you can go, well, it was good on Thursday night, so
exactly.
you can tell me on paper it's not good, I can tell you in the room it was good. So
yeah
what have you kind of I guess come to as your belief in a process of acting, of learning, because as I said, you started acting at a very young age,
yeah,
right? And
yeah.
you've kind of always done that, but then you still chose to go the academic route on
yeah,
it. So what's
yeah.
been what have you come to a conclusion of, if any conclusion can be come to?
Well, I mean, you've instinctively sort of picked it up then, I think, which is I need the balance.
Yeah.
I like to know the rules in order to subvert the rules. I thought for a long time I didn't want to know the rules.
Yeah.
Because I am someone who has very strong instincts. And I was, as you say, someone who was already working from
yeah.
the age of six. I
yeah.
did my first job. It wasn't like I was just doing these classes, which were brilliant classes at the Anna Scher Theatre. And you've had so many ex-AMIS
yeah.
members
yeah.
on this, which I just love. But it was work.
Yeah.
And I got to the point when I was 19, I think 20, and I'd been at the Anna Scher Theatre for 14 years.
Wow.
Doing classes every weekend. I mean, that's every weekend.
Yeah.
Friday night, Saturday afternoon for 14 years, all the way through the teens. I mean, you can imagine.
Yeah.
I sacrificed a lot of
yeah.
party time. But it was amazing because you worked at the same time. So again, I was doing these freeing, interesting, fun classes with Anna Cher, with all these, incredible, mad, we were just all crazy kids.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest. That was Anna Cher's thing.
You went there
because, not because you were a stage school kid who wanted to learn how to tap dance and sing and dance and go out there and be this homogenous sort of, mass of child stars. We were real. And we were always encouraged to be real and keep our quirks and keep our personalities, and that was what was going to be our thing. That was what was going to get us to the artistic places that we wanted to get to. But at the same time, I was in the institution of work. So when I got to 19, I thought, I'm being pigeonholed here.
Right.
I've got to be really careful. I sensed it.
Yeah.
I'm playing a lot of prostitutes, a lot of thieves, a lot of marginalised roles.
Yeah.
I know that I need to go and be in possession of the techniques if I want to really have longevity.
Yeah, of course.
And I felt that. And so I applied to drama school, not because anyone helped me to do it, but because I found a prospectus on the desk at college, in the common room, on a table. And it had three drama schools in it, and I applied to all three of them. I got into one.
Wow.
So that's... I got into two, and I wanted to go to Manchester. Again, point being, as soon as I got there, I knew I was in a bit of trouble.
Right.
Because I knew the institution was going to... I didn't trust it.
It's such a tough one, because the first acting gig I got, or the first feedback I got on an audition that I got the role for... was that the reason I got the role was because I didn't feel like a drama student. And it was an American series, but all medieval England. And they were saying 90% of the British casting was very Shakespearean, theatre over the top. And I just went and did it. Because they said, just do it kind of as you, but in their words. I was like, all right, I'll do that.
Yeah.
And that's what they liked. But equally, I think that can cause you to get lazy. If you go, well, you interpret it yourself. It's a tough one. The thing I found great with the David Mamet book is, I think I would be scared if I ever found something that I just agreed with 100%.
That's it.
Because then I'd probably think, well, I'm being blind here in some way. His chapter on casting directors, I didn't agree with at all, because it's really negative. Every 90% of casting directors I've met have been absolutely amazing and really positive people. But there's loads in there that has just blown me away. It's that kind of... read a couple of pages and then sit there and think about it for a bit. So, I think it's good to have that. Learn from under as many trees as you can and go, well, that's bullshit. That's frilly nonsense. And that bit is gold, I guess.
I'm going to butcher a Jungian quote here. Yeah. I'm just going to butcher it.
Go.
It's learn your techniques well.
Yeah.
But be ready to let them go when you touch the human soul.
Yeah.
And that's...
love it.
For me, that's my mantra.
Yeah.
I wanted to learn techniques. I knew that I was operating in an industry that I would have to work 10 times harder to get roles in. And that there is something about having a degree, end of the day, having a degree, having a level of training, that if you're a woman of colour running out onto the scene, I just knew I'd benefit from having it.
Yeah.
For myself,
completely.
Knowing that I had something undeniable, that I had a training.
Do you think it gives you a little backup of confidence as well to say, no, I've done this, I've got this qualification, I've got this or I've got that, to kind of give you that justification, that reason to be there?
Yeah, it's not the confidence I need for myself, but I just feel like, again, to dismantle the master's house, you're going to need to use the master's tools.
And that's it.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, I've got to come out with the master's tools here.
Yeah.
They're not for me,
but
I know what they are for. And they are helping me, you know, breathing techniques and, techniques on learning how to approach a script. I'm still using to this day.
Yeah, I love that.
But it was more that I knew I would just need it as some kind of shield. And I've spent a long time since drama school trying to really unlearn so much that happened there, because it can be somewhere that breaks you down.
Yeah.
And especially if you're confident and if you have a voice and you have a strong way about you, you can be targeted, and I was, to a certain extent, without playing tiny violin about it. But again... what was amazing is in my final year, you do your dissertation, right? So it's the same as any dissertation. You go away and you individually decide what you want to present that shows your 3 years of learning. But it just so happened at drama school, you can also do a performance-based thing. It's not just written. So you have the written dissertation and you have the performance. And I did a devised piece with a friend of mine that was essentially like a feminist bit of agit punk theatre.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. Still to this day, I'm like, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And we got slammed.
Oh, wow.
We got so slammed. And I was like, right, I'm not having this. So a few days later, we remounted it at a theatre that used to exist in Manchester, which is just so sad it's not there anymore, called The Green Room, which was the most experimental theatre you can get in Manchester probably at that time. And we pitched it to them. And they were like, we want to commission this next year.
Wow.
And I knew that we wouldn't be there. That was what I needed to see, like you're saying, to exist outside of those walls.
Yeah, and it's knowing to trust your own instinct and your own strength. So I had a really weird message on social media recently, and I never read my Instagram DMs for some reason. It's not, there's so many social medias, it's not one that I keep as big an eye on. But I had a message from someone who was saying that I'd listened to the podcast and it had made them decide to get back into acting, and they went and had an audition, and they performed one of my pieces in the way I perform it in one of my music videos.
Amazing.
And they got the role.
Amazing.
And it was amazing and inspirational, but also it made me go, I need to remember what my strengths are as well.
Yeah.
I'm doing all this to try and learn how I am as an actor, study all these different books and try and develop because I've started so late.
Yeah.
And it was a little reminder to go, well, maybe I should be bringing a bit more of that in, into the right rooms, into the right auditions, and going, here's what I can do.
Like, yes.
This is, if someone is going and playing me in an audition and getting the role, then
why can't it was a little I just reminder play of me in the audition and
exactly.
get the role?
It was hysterical. A nice, inspirational reminder to go, right, there's strengths that I'm ignoring at present because I'm so obsessed with the techniques and finding these characters and finding all this. It's like, right, you know, there's the spoken word background, there's stage, there's all this. It's a fascinating one.
It's, well, self-awareness is something you're really supposed to keep at bay when you do what we do, you know, because you have to do the thing and leave it to the audience to decide what it is. You know, there's no point 100%. Going in and patting yourself on the back or, you know, equally tearing yourself down when you're in the middle of doing a poem or a monologue or a song or whatever. But you're right. It can get to a point where you've removed self-awareness so much that you're not actually taking stock of what makes you and what makes the artist in you speak to other people.
I
think that's such a brilliant thing. I played you and someone liked it.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, maybe I should be doing that a bit more. Yeah,
but honestly, screwed. So I think that's the point I've got to in my life where I'm like, why have I cast myself in such a terrible role? I should just cast myself as this amazing leading woman in my own life.
Completely.
I know lots of people feel like this, that you wake up one day and sort of think to yourself, why have I cast myself as a supporting role in my own life? And that's I think what you're describing there is really the moment you get a nudge from the universe, which is saying, step into your power, step into your self,
completely.
You know, and which that takes time.
It must be a tough one. I mean, you kind of touch upon it a few times in your book, but it's something that comes to mind anyway. If you've had from the time that you're developing as a person, as your own character, you're having to play so many characters.
Yeah.
It must be really tough to know who you are and to find who you are. Because reading it, the times it touched upon that, I really related because. And it made me go and sit and think about it a bit because I was like, well, I play Scroobius Pip to all these people on social media or whatever else.
Yeah.
But then I kind of came to the conclusion that, well, that's because I've made myself into who I want to be. Scroobius Pip is who I want to be. Therefore, I've worked to become that. Therefore, it's not a character. It is me. It is me being me. And it was a really interesting one to kind of try and break down because, again, it is hard if you're so used to even removing our industries. If you're at work, you might have to play a certain character. If you're in the office or whatever else, and then it starts to be, well, who is the real me? So how have you found that? And Yeah, how's that kind of affected you over the years? Because from such an early age, the reason it stood out to me was it was in the developmental years.
Yes.
I didn't have that. I grew up just being me, had the developmental years, and then start to look into other stuff. But you, from that early age, it's like, well, no, you're this person, and now you're that person.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably just manifested itself as a full-on split personality disorder. I'm joking, and I'm not poking fun at split personality disorders, but I think there is something to be said for suddenly realising how many roles you've been playing for years. And again, I think that is such a universal thing. I don't think that's just an actory thing.
Yeah.
I was made aware of it much younger, as you say, because I started being other people at a very, very fragile stage in my cognitive development. But I just find it fascinating just how many roles we do play as people.
Completely.
And I think so much about writing this book has that actually just been about accepting that and giving myself a bit of credit, because everyone does it. I don't know if I believe 100%. In this who is the real you. There are relationships I've made in the past year where I've gone, oh wow, I really like myself when I'm with that person. Mm. I'm different. Parts of me that I didn't really know existed have come out. I like this. So to think that we have to sort of set this cake tin and then it'll be cooked and that's, you slice it up and give it out, it's just insane.
There's a Fernando Pessoa has got a book called The Book of Disquiet. And in that, he talks about, it's my favourite book. It was another one. It's like I read it's weird because it's not in chapters. It was all found after he had died. And it's kind of a collection of his notes and ideas. But in that, he talks about how his belief is that we never truly love anyone else. And that sounds really negative. I've had this discussion. It's been a bad discussion in relationships in the past. But, his point is, it's because we can never truly know someone else because we always put on some kind of mask, whoever we're around. I will be different around my old schoolmates than I am around my on-set mates. I'll be different around my mum than I am, even around my dad, potentially.
Yeah, of course.
It doesn't mean anything's false, but it means that the person that we're madly in love with is the version of them that we've created in our mind rather than the reality of them, because we can never know the reality of someone. As you said, there probably isn't a reality of anyone. We don't, that true you, that true self. And it's always blown my mind. And every time, often I'll try and talk about it. Again, it's not gone down well when, like, there's been a new relationship and we're having a late night chat and I'm going, I don't really believe in love.
I
don't think it's
a... could never truly love you, right?
And you could never truly love me because you will never know me. It's like, all right, this sounds like a great relationship. But it's a fascinating one. And it plays to what you were saying there of the real you.
Yeah.
It's a fiction. It's a fiction to you and to everyone else. But
it's
not negative. The point I always try and make when explaining that topic is I'm not saying it as a negative thing. It's just a reality that... Yeah, we've got all these different versions and parts of ourselves that we don't necessarily want to show to every person that we meet, and rightfully so.
I agree. And you know, as I start to talk about the book, and I haven't talked about it that much, this is probably like the fifth time I've talked about it in an interview situation. Yeah. And the talking about it is the understanding it for me.
Yeah.
I didn't share it really when I first wrote it because I was... too scared. It was secretive. It was my thing. And also I had to really try and convince my brain that it wasn't actually happening. Otherwise I think I would have gone into meltdown.
Yeah.
But every person I talk to who's an intelligent and open person like yourself gives me like another title for the book.
Yeah.
And that's what I use to try and understand it. And what you just said then, the real you is a fiction, could be an alternative title of my book.
Completely.
Because I do believe that. I have been listening and watching a lot of videos of a brilliant relationship counsellor called Esther Perel in Research for Betrayal, which I'm doing now. And she talks about love, obviously. She's a relationship counsellor.
Yeah.
Love, the complications of being in a relationship with someone else. Mm. And specifically when I was watching Stuff for Betrayal, what potentially that moment is when you look outside of the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, infidelity is an unfortunate and inconvenient truth. We are primal beings and we're interesting, complicated beings. And she talks about when you try and look outside of a relationship, or when you have love and you start looking for other love outside of that love, what you are potentially looking for is your other self.
Yeah.
That it's actually not about that other person.
Yeah.
It's about you finding or needing another self. So I completely agree with you on what you said there. I don't know that it's a fact of not ever being able to love someone else, but I do believe that loving someone else isn't as simple as here's someone standing in front of me and I love them.
Yeah.
It's always related to where you are individually as yourself.
Completely. So how is it, let's get on to betrayal. How is it to be part of something I like that? Because it's an amazing piece. It's an incredibly intimate piece on stage. There's only three of you in the main roles. And again, it's Charlie Cox and Tom Hiddleston. So it's huge names. How's that been to kind of lose yourself in that and find the character and then equally maintain the character for an extended run where you're doing it constantly, week after week, a couple of times a day on some days? How is that all as a process?
I think we're just held up by Harold, to be honest.
Yeah.
The pinter of it all is so deep.
Yeah.
His work is so deep and it's addictive. And the three of us are such a team. We've actually been nicknamed the Thruple.
Great.
It's actually a thing, Thruples.
Yeah.
Because since day one, we've just really bonded. And I can honestly say I've never been so happy at work.
I
never say that.
Yeah.
It's really important to be able to say that sometimes.
Yeah.
You don't have to be miserable at work. I thought that was just something that went along sometimes with being at work.
Which, of course, if you're not miserable in a job, then it's not real work.
It's not real work.
Yeah.
Come on, what are you doing? You're just having a laugh, aren't you? You're getting paid for it. But this is honestly one of the most transformative experiences I've ever had. And I think that is because we are three actors who are all very, very similar ages to the character. You know, it's all very real. It's all very, I mean, Harold's work is just so brutally beautiful that I just think it just goes to the core of people. You know, when you're really talking about people, you know, if we're going to play about relationships, let's not all be riding unicorns and, you know, blowing heart-shaped bubbles out of our asses. Let's actually go into what loving is about. And like you're saying, where it can take you in your emotional life.
Yeah.
And this is a play about a woman who has a set, you know, it's not about her specifically, it's about three people, but I play a woman who's had this affair for 7 years and kept it secret from her husband, and she's having the affair with her husband's best friend, and there's a betrayal between the two of them, obviously, because their relationship is so strong. And that's life. And the way Harold writes is so poetic. In fact, I've got a book of his poems up there, and he's a poet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he also understands that where there's love, sometimes there's also hate, and there can be violence, and there can be self-hate, and there can be tenderness, and there can be brutality. And I think we've just all really absorbed it, and getting it right, getting the way he writes right, along with the pauses and the silences that just, you know, I mean, they make my stomach drop out every night because it's so hard to just shut up on stage and trust that it's going to carry.
Yeah.
But it's, I think it's really gotten under all of our skins and we're just loving it.
It must be amazing to have a piece to work with that you can have that much faith and trust in. Again, another thing in the book I'm reading at the moment is just saying, it's not being disrespectful, but it's saying the actors, it's not your job to make the play good.
No.
It's your job to perform
the
actions and needs of your character.
Yes.
Everything else, that's on the writer. The player's got that covered. If it's rubbish, it'll be rubbish. You can't solve that. If it's great, it'll be great.
That's it.
Almost in spite of what you do up there. You know, you can bring the most out of it. And
that's it.
That's what it feels like with Pin. It's just, the thing I loved when I came along was the amount of laughs that aren't played for in any way.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's there. And none of you are playing for laughs or doing anything to push the laughs. You're playing it all as a reality.
Yeah.
And there's so many points that you shouldn't be laughing at it because it's a really dark, harsh thing that's been said. And you're like,
Do you know? And Pinter called it a comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
He called it a comedy. And you think, how can this brutal, unbelievably sad play be a comedy? And that's Harold. And it is. It's really, really funny. And it's also, what's the word I'm looking for? You can be a conduit for this play.
Yeah.
Because Harold has written it from such a personal place. I mean, you know, people try and simplify it and say, oh, it's based on the affair he had famously with Joan Bakewell, you know, and things like that. And that's oversimplifying it. Yeah. But I think when you are an actor and you are working on material that has clearly come from the absolute well of truth inside an artist, you just feel it.
Yeah.
And you just can be a conduit. You don't have to redraft it as you're going,
yeah,
you know.
Completely.
And you forget to work on good writing, as you know, as an actor, is it can be really, really rare.
Yeah.
And you do end up playing a couple of roles. You're like, oh God, right, I'm an editor here.
Yep.
I'm going to cut that line, right, and get rid of that. Oh, no, that's terrible, right, I'm going to have to be a sort of producer on this line and, you know, end up making sure that I've got an interesting outfit, because actually when I say these words, they're so boring, how's anyone going to stay awake? And with Harold's work, you do just get to get on with the intuiting and the spiritual elements of acting that I enjoy.
How's it been taking it from rehearsal to in front of people? Because it's another thing that struck me, that some of those moments of lightness you probably can't identify until there's an audience in front of you. In rehearsal, you might not have known that that's a funny point, but now there's kind of a pause because there's laughter there, you know?
I died on our first preview.
Yeah.
I went, oh, shit. Everyone else is in a comedy and I'm in a drama. I was like, oh, no. Because there was this laughter that we'd obviously never heard. And I thought, oh, great, I'm just the woman who comes on and is sort of wringing her hands and sort of desperately, you know, emoting all over the place. And actually the holding of the nerve is to do what you've rehearsed.
Yeah.
Because that audience is powerful. Any audience is powerful. But they will try and make it the play they want to see.
Yeah.
If they want it to be a comedy, they're going to drag you into a comedy. If they want it to be a drama, they're going to be silent as the grave.
I love that. That's so exciting, though, as an organic thing to be involved in, that it is an interaction rather than an offering, you know?
100%. It's sticking to what we rehearse, and we rehearse in a very organic way. Jamie Lloyd, who's directed the play, is
the direction's amazing. It looks stunning. The movement of the stage and everything is just, it's mind-blowing.
Suta Gilmore designed our set, which is, I mean, if you want to come just to see the set, just come and see the set.
Yeah.
John Clark, who just won an Olivier on Sunday for another thing that he did, he's just a genius, and he did our incredible lighting, which is very filmic, and it just works with the triangle. You know, we've got these incredible shadows on the back of our stage, and usually this play is not staged with the other person in a scene, the three of us stay on stage the entire time. Yeah. And so you just get the sense of this web that they're all in, you know. I veered off my answer, really. But Harold Pinter, he liked his actors to be, you know, confrontational.
Yeah.
He had so many bad reviews at the beginning.
Right.
People saying this is awful, you know, plays coming off early. And he talks about, I think, a performance maybe in New York. I forget of which play. Maybe it was The Birthday Party or maybe it was The Caretaker. I can't remember. And he said what he loved was watching people like fidget and maybe want to move and be totally uncomfortable and see the actors on the stage just like, God help me, I am going to finish this play and you're going to wait until the end.
Yeah.
And he said by the end, the audience loved them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think it's a real lesson as an actor when you go, you cannot work for an audience. You have to work for the truth of what you've created and just trust that the response you get will be the truthful response and the right response.
Yeah, I love that. It's having faith in the art of it all, I guess, or the balance of the art of it all and the awareness that it's a performance. As I said, the crowd are part of it. It's submitting to that, but knowing that here's what I set out to do and here's what...
Exactly.
Here's what works. This bit's going to be a bit weird. I made a note of it and I tried to word it so it doesn't make me sound like a psychopath. But are you a fan of art? Because Velvet Buzzsaw, I really enjoyed.
Oh,
and it's amazing.
You.
Look at the art world. It was great. The year before, a film called The Square came out, which is also
Ruben,
it was my film of the year. It's just amazing.
Same.
But I also really enjoyed Random Acts. And the weird part here that makes me sound like a stalker is I went to the opening of the Tate Britain, and I remember seeing you there. And we didn't particularly know each other, but I'd watched Fresh Meat recently.
Oh,
and
I was like,
that's the gal of Fresh Meat, isn't it?
Oh, and kind of, so hysterical.
It made me think. It then, when Random Acts, which is a lot of art stuff, and when this came out, I was like, well, I know I've seen you at art stuff, so I know there's a love of art there as well. Yeah. So is that part of taking these particular roles, or does that make it exciting when it's like Random Acts was this amazing kind of celebration of odd art, unusual stuff that wouldn't be out there, and Velvet Buzzsaw is really, again, another kind of damning look at the art world, but also a celebratory look at the art world. So, how much does art play a part in your life and your loves?
It plays a big part in my life. I think I didn't realise how much so. I got cast in this Tom Ford film called Nocturnal Animals as a gallery owner, as a gallery assistant, sorry.
Amazing as well.
Amazing film. I love that film. You know, 2 minutes of heaven with me. I mean, blink and you miss it. But I was suddenly like, oh, I sort of feel like I really suit this world.
Yeah.
And then it was just weirdly again, then I was cast as someone else who worked in the gallery in Velvet Buzzsaw. And then I ended up doing a documentary for the Tate, for their Soul of a Nation exhibition.
Right.
That was amazing. So I went and met this incredible abstract performance artist called Lorraine O'Grady, who I'd always wondered about. Her name was kind of always in my atmosphere or in my subconscious because of a La Tigre track that says her name. Says the name of all these brilliant feminist icons and says Lorraine O'Grady. And so suddenly I was on my way to interview her and I was like, this has always sort of been in my mind. So I think the art world is something that's kind of always been in my subconscious, but it was when I started getting cast in these roles that it sort of obviously came into the conscious realm. I think I just like abstract things.
It's such a fascinating world to put on camera because it's so kind of almost similar to the film industry. It's so ludicrous and so stupid and pointless, but also so important and so essential. It's such a weird juxtaposition of
totally.
And both Velvet Buzzsaw and The Square, I think, both trod that line beautifully of making you get to the point where you're like, this is all so ludicrous, and then making one little point going, oh man, that's beautiful.
That's actually really beautiful.
God damn it. I was so looking down my nose at this, and now you've gone, look at this. You're like, oh, wow.
I think that world just treads the line that, you know, you said earlier in the conversation that I tread, which is this line between true artistic instinct and primal, historic, ancestral vibes and commerciality, you know, institutional worlds. I just like that line.
Yeah.
And I think the artists who I really love are the ones who somehow manage to kind of use the world to their own ends and be them and get success and get notoriety and get seen. Because essentially you want your art to be seen.
Yeah.
But also never, ever, ever lost themselves. I'm doing the Sky Arts Portrait Prize tomorrow. So I'm actually going to have to sit still for 4 hours. I've never had my portrait done before.
Yeah.
And usually this would be the kind of thing that I would hate. But I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I feel like there's something in... And actually they're basing that particular episode on Basquiat, on the life and work of Basquiat, who's one of my favourite artists of all time.
Same, yeah.
His work makes me cry.
Yeah.
I look at it and I just start crying.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that it's like bright yellow and zany.
Yeah.
I just feel the pain.
Yeah.
And having my portrait done tomorrow feels like it's sort of bringing everything together, a bit like what you're saying.
Yeah.
My love of art, my love of abstraction, my love of interpretation, my love of character, my love of truth, my love of the moving image, the still image, everything. It feels like by sitting tomorrow to have my portrait done, I get to sort of capture this moment that is happening for me at the moment. And work aside, it's happening for me, Zowie.
Yeah.
I'm at this precipice right now where I just feel like I'm just starting to get it. I'm starting to understand it. Childhood coping mechanisms are starting to fade away.
Yeah.
My adult self, And that was in the writing of the book, actually. That was the part of the catharsis. My adult self is suddenly, you know, suddenly stepping through, and I just feel in flow. You know, in flow? Yeah, when you're just in flow.
Yeah. I love it. I love it when you can, again, it's the realisation that you can't realise at the time, but all of these things that you've gone through are leading to something, or are teaching you something. And again, it's such a simple thing to say to people, because like I said, in the moment, it doesn't mean a thing.
No.
It doesn't help in any way, but it is beautiful when you get there. It's something, I spoke to Winston Duke, who was in Black Panther and is in Us.
Can't wait to see Us.
And it's great. And he talked about, and it's something I want to kind of talk to you about. In fact, I'll frame it there first. I was reluctant. I try not to be that interviewer that goes, so what's it like being a woman in the industry? Because it's so shit. But it just struck me, particularly from reading the book, that you're someone who's been in the industry during the period when you're treated very different for being a woman or for being a person of colour.
Mm.
And now we're at a point where both of those are having kind of a renaissance in the... It's tough to say renaissance because it suggests that they ever were given the opportunity that they deserved in the first place. But they're kind of having this push through.
Mm.
And it's a beautiful thing. And when I spoke to Winston Duke about it, he was saying, he put it perfectly. He said he spent the first 15 to 20 years of his career preparing for a revolution he didn't know was coming.
Yeah.
And now he's in Black Panther, he's in Us. He's like, I was prepared. But the beauty there is that he was preparing for it without even knowing it's coming. Do you know what I mean? That's what I loved, was that he was studying, he was learning, potentially to be in the background or to be the black best friend in the only obvious roles that are about. And it's going to be a similar thing for when you came up again, like when I had Riz Ahmed on 4 years ago now, or 5 years ago now, he spoke of going to America to get good roles, because in the UK so much of the home production was period, they didn't particularly like having brown people in period stuff, in his words. So he went to America and was suddenly playing interesting characters and deep and rich characters. So how have you found that? I guess I'm stumbling around the transition from, as you said, at 19 being cast a lot as prostitutes and people on the wrong side of the tracks to now being art gallery owners and things like that. And that change, have you felt it, and have you been conscious of it, I guess?
I don't think I have been that conscious of it. That's probably the Eeyore-ish part of my personality, which is a big part. I'm just sort of rolling that phrase around in my head a bit, the preparing for a revolution.
Yeah.
Preparing for a revolution. I think for me, because I started so young and because I grew up through such a different time. Well, actually, I'm going to be honest. The 90s felt like a great time.
Right.
For a better time, weirdly, for people of color, maybe certainly on television. You know, we had shows like Desmond's, The Real McCoy.
Yeah, sure.
There felt like there were lots of TV hosts of color. I don't know. And then it kind of went south a bit, and you never saw black people on TV ever. Certainly not.
It seems to be that weird thing of them going, running family
dramas. Yeah.
Oh, we've done that now. It's like, what do you mean you've done that? There's a lot more.
We're still here. Yeah, yeah. Hello. We haven't gone anywhere. So I think for me, again, because I started at such a young age, for me it's been about the human revolution. I think it's been about my own personal human revolution, and that is what has led me to the work that I'm supposed to be doing. I tried to stop at the end of 2017. I'm sort of telling everyone, and there's not really any reason to tell anyone, but yeah, it's part of my journey. I tried to quit acting. I thought, I'm not suited to this. I don't feel like there are many artists left. I don't know where the work that is going to make me feel super nourished is. Mm. Because it's just certain work that I just know I'm meant for and that I can do.
Yeah.
Again, I consider myself to be an abstract artist. And if you are a woman of colour and that is the work you want to do, I've found that you can struggle, because there will be doors that open to you if you are offering up a literal story of your experience. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot of this when I did this documentary for the Tate and talked to Lorraine O'Grady, and she put it in brilliant words. You know, she said that there were artists who were doing work, who were artists of colour, that got bought up and sold because they were telling the story of their experience or of their pain as people of colour in this extremely up and down, easy to box way, you know, in a photographic way, a literal way.
Yeah.
And she was coming out on the scene going, I'm telling the same story, but I'm going to stand in a huge warehouse or, you know, room and whip myself with hundreds of pairs of white gloves to represent colonialism. Do you know what I mean? And people go, okay, that's the work that we do not want to give any kind of platform to.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it's really been about holding my nerve as someone who is of colour and a woman and also abstract. Because when I wanted to stop, I just felt there wasn't space for that.
Yeah.
And now, since wanting to quit, I did Velvet Buzzsaw. It's an abstract, beautiful, bonkers thing from the, you know, the brilliant mind of Dan Gilroy. You know, him and I collaborated in such an incredible way. And I was like, oh, yeah, there are artists who are out there trying to say something really different and want to use people like me who aren't the norm for roles like this because that's how they see the world.
Yeah.
Not because they're doing any favours to anyone, but this is how they see the world. And that was a beautiful, transformative experience for me from a career standpoint and from a personal standpoint. And now I'm doing Betrayal. I think I'm, you know, I'm probably the first dual heritage woman to play this role in this, you know, age old, brilliant British classic. And that feels abstract and brilliant too. And the play is challenging and not literal and not, you know, one thing. And that's the work I want to do. So I think there is a revolution happening, but for me, it's all been about a personal revolution.
Yeah, yeah. Do you plan on writing at all for TV, for film, for the stage? Because the book, the structure of it is it's parts of it are written as sides.
Yeah.
The real life, the kind of real life engagements are written as sides, and the work type bits are written as prose almost. And it's I love
tells you how I see the world, doesn't
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Again, but I love that as a setup and as a straight forward explanation of the dual world of living as or growing up as an actor.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something that struck me as you were speaking then, that it's like, number one, I'm glad you didn't leave it. I was going to say give up, but I think that's a negative term. Leave in 2017.
Yeah.
But number two, that you can create the roles that you want and create the worlds that you want to work in. And that's kind of an exciting thing. I feel like I'm constantly referencing this David Mamet book again. I don't agree with all of it, but still, a thing he talks about a lot in there is he comes from more theatre. He talks a bit about film, but in general, he's talking about theatre, but it translates across. And he's saying that the true beauty is when you realise that you can start your own theatre and start your own productions and not chase Hollywood and not chase Broadway and this kind of thing. And that feels like, again, from what you were saying there, of this feeling of negativity towards the roles that were available, but then having seen how your mind works and how you write, it seems logical to go, well, and I know you've written and directed some shorts in the past, it just seemed logical then to go, well, create them, create these worlds and create these environments that have been influenced by the people you've loved working with and that you've loved being engaged in this world with. And equally as influenced by those you haven't enjoyed and those scenarios 100%. And situations, you know.
That's such a great point. Yes, I am writing, and, you know, I had a long period of time where I was sort of trapped in developmental hell with things and that can really, really knock your confidence. But I'm so ready to be the centre of the work. You know, I think my journey right now is attempting to be the subject and object of what I do. And whether that's in my life or in my work. And that's totally, that has everything to do with writing.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the writer is the reason everyone shows up in the fucking first place. Do you know what I mean? They get treated so badly, writers. I am writing something for myself. I want to write something feature length anyway to direct, because I've just got the capacity for it now. Yeah. I've just got the capacity to sort of see something in my mind's eye through an artistic lens that lasts 90 minutes rather than 15 minutes.
Yeah.
That's just something that's just come upon me recently.
Timing. It's so much about timing that is, again, it's finding that place, not even in necessarily in your professional life, but in your own life, that you're in that place to have that faith and trust in an idea or in a project or in a vision.
It has to be. I mean, a really good way to sum up my experience really as a writer is the journey of a play I wrote 10 years ago when I was 24 called For All the Women Who Thought They Were Mad. And I wrote that as part of the Royal Court Young Writers Group, and it was shortlisted for their, you know, really, you know, notorious and big festival. And that was a massive moment, and we had an incredible reading there, and the play showed so much promise. It's really about the very quiet and yet deadly epidemic, which is to do with black women or women from the African diaspora and their relationship to medication in the West, their relationship to the hospitals, to institutions in general, but specifically hospitals in this play, and how if you go into a GP's office or into an ER or whatever it might be, and there's a cultural gap in your communication with the people who are supposed to be helping you, you can end up in a very, very dire situation.
Yeah.
You can end up over-medicated. You can end up losing yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've described that right, but it's the play is a hot potato, put it that way. And every single character, bar one, is a black woman.
Yeah.
And most of them are over the age of 30, 40.
Yeah.
So I'm this 24-year-old carting around this play that people who read it are so drawn to it, but at the same time run from it like it's a bomb about to be let off because of the components that make it what it is and the way that people read on the page. Black women, this is never going to make money. Black women over the age of... Right, okay, this definitely isn't going to make money. Oh, this is about an epidemic that no one really wants to talk about. Okay, we're definitely not doing this play. And I had this really weird... I was sort of 10 years in the wilderness with this play, to be honest, because people didn't want to do it. Again, like I said, people were so attracted to it, loved it, wanted to work on it, wanted me to workshop it, all this stuff, and would never commit.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is starting to be a fucking... This is a metaphor here.
Yeah.
This is such a long time that I'm receiving this treatment.
Yeah.
This is a metaphor of what's happening in my industry.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way the women and the people in this play are being treated is exactly what I've written about.
Yeah.
This is just this is too meta really for me now. And I tried to put it in a drawer and walk away from it. And a brilliant company called Hackney Showroom made me bring it out. And suddenly 10 years later, we're doing a production of it completely independently fine. Producer has reached out and we're funding it and we're doing it at Stoke Newington Town Hall at the end of this year. But then also it's going to go on at Soho Rep in New York, is one of my favourite theatres. So it's sort of, again, it's just that holding your nerve thing.
Yeah.
If you've got something to say that is not the norm, you might have to wait a bit longer. So that's a really long way of saying my relationship to writing now is about being the object and the subject and trying to make work as independently as possible than wait for the invite.
It's beautiful because, again, it's that, it's having faith as we started kind of, in your voice and what you believe the art to be, because at the end of the day it is art, so there's going to be people who don't like it, and that's that you can't let that dampen your enthusiasm. Obviously you can analyze and you can reassess, but you can't let it dampen it. And I love that 10 years on it's like, no, it's still there. It's going to happen now.
It's going to happen in two places at the same time. Yeah. It is mind blowing, and it is, again, Pinterest brings to mind, people slating him, saying this is abominable work, this is dangerous work, and now here I am sat in the Harold Pinter Theatre in the centre of the West End at the end of one of the most epic seasons of his work. It's a lesson in holding your nerve and being as honest with yourself about who you are.
Yeah,
that's the only way I'm getting things done at the moment, to be honest.
I love it. I'll I'll wrap things up now, as I want you to have some time to relax and rest before getting on. But just before we do, I mean, we've gone this whole time and we've not talked about a fresh meat at all.
Ah.
And that was the one that really, it's where I first kind of found you or knew. Because again, you'd been in a lot of things, but it was always, this was a real, it must have been such a great role, right? Because it was such a standout character in a show of standout characters as such. So how was that to be part of? It felt like, it looked like it was a lot of fun. So.
Yeah, it was the best. Yeah. It was the best time. You rarely get chances in your life to have a coming of age again.
Yeah.
And every single one of us on that show did.
Yeah.
Because we did have a second studentdom.
Yeah.
As
adults. Yeah, completely.
It was just one of the best times of my life. And to have your head go above the parapet, which is really what happened at that time, like you're saying, you know, you're slogging away and doing the whole thing. And, you know, as the phrase goes, it takes a lifetime to become a newcomer, and that's all fine. But, you know, I'd already been working 20 odd years, and then suddenly your head goes above the parapet with something like Fresh Meat. It was amazing, because you want that to happen with something you love. And the beauty of it being such
an ensemble piece as well was a thing that got me. There's not really a lead. No. Every character whoever watches it could see someone else as the lead. And that's, 100%. Again, that must be a great thing to work on, because it feels like it probably takes a bit of the pressure off, because no one is, and it takes ego away as well, because no 100%. One is walking around being, well, this is my show, really.
And if you did, you would fall so flat on your face.
Yeah.
It's ensemble comedy drama at its purest. And I think that's what people responded to as well. As you're saying, it was, I don't know, I think it was reminiscent for people of something like The Young Ones, you know, something completely. Like An Only Fools and Horses. You know, you just think, these six people, you know, these few people, they look, I think we look quite sort of shambolic in lots of different ways. And that's what gave it its sort of culty edge.
Yeah.
Vob was a character I never ever expected people to take to their hearts. I was so scared that I was the one ruining the show.
Yeah.
So as unhelpful as it is to think in an ensemble I'm the best, I realise now it was also unhelpful to think you're the worst, you know. And so I had to have a proper conversation with myself halfway through. And actually I spoke to a friend of mine and I said, I'm not funny. I don't know what I'm doing. I need to get out of here. I'm killing this for the other five people. They're so brilliant. Just, what do I do? And she was like, well, you don't have to be the belly laugh, do you? You can be the wry smile character. Brilliant. And that was the thing that got me through. Brilliant. I was like, all I'm after is a wry smile. It's fine. It's fine. Just get on with it. And then I escaped the country when Fresh Meat came out. So I had to go to a wedding, but I went to Cuba and I extended the stay because I deliberately didn't want to be here at the time when it came out. Yeah. So I was so nervous.
Wow.
And I looked so much like Vod as well. I've never had my head shaved in my life. And suddenly I have a shaved head and people are going to know who I am, right?
Yeah.
And I got an email from Tony Gardner, who plays Tony Shales in the show, who obviously on the show is my mortal enemy. But he emailed and said, I've just watched episode one. I think you should all prepare for things to be very different. I thought, what does that mean? Does that mean people like it?
Wow.
What's going on?
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, Vod was a thing. Vod is God.
Yeah.
It was a thing. It was a massive confidence boost, because I was sure the choices that I made were just too hammy, too weird. The voice was just too odd. The androgyny was a step too far. I just thought everything was destined to fail, and the exact opposite happened.
I'm so
grateful.
It's something that I look at when, because again, I do try and watch things kind of studying and learning. Even before I was doing acting, it was always kind of that beautiful thing. And I think Vod, it's going to sound like an odd one, but it's the fact that it was such an unusual voice, such an unusual approach, but it was persisted with and got through. It's what I loved about the first few times I saw Tom Hardy. I always remember in the take, he gave his character a ridiculous voice, but it was so intimidating.
So,
and then you look at Christian Bale as Batman, it's like, that's stupid. He's playing that ludicrously, but it's amazing. It's what got it through. It was taking that really bold choice and going, this works, fuck you.
Yeah, that is totally it.
Yeah.
And you're never rewarded in life, but you're hardly ever rewarded I'm going to put it in personal time. I've hardly ever been rewarded in my life by not giving any of the fucks.
Yeah.
And that was the time I just didn't.
Yeah.
And I got rewarded.
Yeah.
And so it was just a game changer in every sense of the word, really. Yeah. I miss her a lot. I really, really miss her.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd be able to play her now.
Yeah.
If someone said, oh, go and do another... I don't know, do a Christmas special.
Would you feel as if you're you playing VOD now rather than actually you playing... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you were
playing VOD, but now VOD has become this thing that you're now detached from.
Yeah.
You would then have to go in and play your version of you playing... It's sort of weird...
Because it was so specific, you're right, to that time of our lives. Yeah. I think all of us would struggle because we just know too much now, and we were much more innocent then and created all of our characters from a much more, you know, from a not a self-aware place, really. It's so funny, I saw Kimberly Nixon quite recently, and she always jokes saying, what about the day when you come in with like a tray of drinks and snacks for your kids and their friends and they're watching reruns of Fresh Meat on Dave? What does that moment look like? Yeah, how is that going to... Do you know what I mean? But that's like... Hey, you've created some iconic British comedy, and I hope it lasts the test of time.
Love it. So, what's the plan going forward? Is it going to? Are you in a position now? It feels like you're in a place to pick and choose the film and TV work that you want to do.
I'm glad it looks like that. I'm not.
I know, but I mean, but not feel that you have to take anything that comes along, but be able to go. I like that. I'm into that, and maybe that comes from choosing to at one point almost walk away.
Yeah.
I guess what is the plan and outlook there? Do you see a lot more TV and film coming? Are you in love with the theatre at the moment, or what's the...
Scroobs, honestly, I don't know. I am going to take some time to really think about what I want to do with the rest of my life after Pinter, I think.
Yeah.
There's nothing... You know, to be honest, and I'm sure people project very different things on me and lots of other actors in my position, but I don't have anything else lined up.
Yeah.
I'm quite happily doing the play and not auditioning. I'm quite happily have a book out there. I quite happily have this film on Netflix that is bonkers and bizarre and something I never thought I'd get in a million years, and I'm just sitting with it. For the first time ever, I'm just really not in a rush. So I'm... The thing I would love next is to just do some really lucrative, cheesy things.
Yeah.
Someone give me a voiceover.
Yeah.
I'd happily do an appearance on any kind of strange TV program.
I mean,
here or abroad, and just pay the bills.
Oh, one of the things I'd note to talk about is something you did a voiceover on, 24 Hours in Police Custody, because I proper rate that show.
Everyone
like, genuinely,
show.
I think it's fantastic.
I didn't recognise
your voice on it at all until it came up at the end. I was like, of course it is.
Isn't that hysterical?
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
I'd like to hide in plain sight for a bit longer, somehow be paid to do it. I don't know how that's going to work.
Perfect.
You know, any endorsements if you need me. You know, like, I'm properly ready to do like an Anthea Turner holding a flake on my wedding day. Like, that is where... Because it is, again, you know... using whatever platform I have right now to take the space and the time to make sure that the next thing I do is something I'm really meant to be doing. Because I've got three of those things in my hand right now, and it feels too good to compromise at this point.
I love that. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's so nice to see you.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. How was that? I hope you enjoyed it. It felt as if we could have talked for hours and hours and hours on end. But obviously there's performances to be done. So we didn't get to chat quite as long. Zoe was on... whose podcast did I listen to on? I think it was on Buxton. Not sure. It was on someone. And she talked about Dancing with Prince. And obviously, I'm a massive Prince fan, so I wanted to get into that. But I didn't get around to it. Oh, the other thing that we mentioned, I said at the beginning I'd plug all the things. I briefly mentioned Pod Bible, which is the UK's first and number one podcast magazine. It's available online now and physically. It's free. So head to podbiblemag.com and you can check out Pod Bible. Yeah, next week's guest is the wonderful Nish Kumar. It's the first time me and Nish had sat down together, and it felt like sitting down with an old friend. I don't like to tell people the guest too far ahead of time, but the week after Nish is an old friend of Nish's, so that's a link of some sort. I'm tired, okay? But yeah, that'll be next week. It's going to be cracking. Head to patreon.com/ScroobiusPip if you want the previews of the guests. In fact, I need to hype quickly. I've got one coming up. I don't normally give guests away, but I've got an episode coming up with Tim Clare, who's a spoken word artist, a poet, and an author. And it's one of the best conversations I've had. It's really, really good. I know it's not the biggest name in the world, but I want to pre-hype it a bit because it's really good. We go really deep. I discuss some stuff I've never discussed. Not only never discussed on the podcast before, but never discussed with anyone before. So, but it's really positive, and he gives some amazing advice on beating writer's block and beating procrastination and all these kind of things. It's really good. I really recommend that. So that's going to be in 3 weeks. I think I've got two more guests ahead of Tim, but I wanted to hype it now. I should also mention that, did you hear our new outro? And my goddaughter Lola, who recorded the original one, went to stay with Buddy Peace and his wonderful missus. And she went with her sister and her mum. And while they were there, because my goddaughter Lola was the original voice on the Distraction Pieces outro, but it was when she could barely talk. And now she's more grown up and can talk. So we figured, or Buddy figured, and rightfully so, he said, let's do a new one. Let's update it. It's been 5 years. So yeah, we did that. Anyway, I'm rambling. I will see you all soon. As said, come... And I never plug my socials anymore, but come hang out on the socials and chat and engage. It's really important that you guys engage and interact. The socials are getting more and more buried under algorithms and paywalls and stuff. So, you know, I generally appreciate and value the interaction that I get from you guys as and when you choose to. So do more of that. Come have a chat. All right, I'll be back next week with the wonderful Nish Kumar. This has been the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 263.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.